Welcome to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy with Brent Lee and Neil Sanders. This is the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. On the 22nd of May, 2017, Salman Abedi detonated a bomb in the foyer of the Manchester Arena at the end of an Ariana Grande concert, killing 22 people and injuring hundreds more. A conspiracy theory claiming that this bombing was hoaxed and everyone involved was a crisis actor soon became a dominant narrative in the conspirasphere. One of the main proponents of this theory is Richard D. Hall. Over the course of this series, we will be examining the claims made by Richard D. Hall, as told in his book and documentary, Night of the Bang. Please be aware, this series will be examining a deadly bombing, and we will be discussing details of death and injury. Listener discretion is advised. This is part 3.
Right, Rich Planet, Night of the Bang, part 3. Because there's no CCTV, we only have witness statements, and so careful analysis of their words is a vital part of our investigation. In the database, Richard identifies 53 groups of participants who claim to have been in the foyer when the bang occurred, and 5 groups of responders who went in to help. So Richard goes on a road trip in the film, basically. He goes to 20-odd separate addresses with a view to speaking to people who were involved in the incident or speaking to the relatives of the supposed dead. And he goes to 20 different addresses, one in West Wales, North Wales, Rhyl, Liverpool, Preston, Manchester, Macclesfield, Barnsley, Leeds, York, Hull, and Newcastle. And so he goes to the former home of Charlotte Campbell, who's the mother of Olivia Campbell, who was one of the people who sadly died or supposedly died. And Richard starts asking the neighbours if they think that Olivia might still be alive. And he says that he's quite surprised that they're quite surprised at this idea. He says that people obviously believe the official story. And then completely out of nowhere, he speculates that Charlotte Campbell, the mother of this dead child, is all about the money and that her and her deceased daughter were not very close. I don't know why he does that, but he does.
No evidence, no?
No.
It's quite special to say they're not close, though.
Yeah, I mean, this woman has got her daughter's name and her birth date and death date tattooed across her heart. But anyway, that's what Richard says. He then decides to set up a hidden camera outside the home of Eve Hibbert. Now, there's several things. One, for some reason, this part is removed from the film on Richard's site. This bit was the bit when I first watched the film, I went, oh, for fuck's sake, mate, what are you doing? Right? Because in the film, he puts a camera, he disguises it in with leaves, and he puts it in a big flower pot that he insinuates is outside of these people's homes. So he basically has put a hidden camera in their garden to secretly film a child in their own home.
Yeah.
Right? He later changes his mind and says, oh, I didn't leave it in the garden. That would be mental. I left it in the van across the street, van that I was sleeping in, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Now, it begs the question, why has he removed it from his film? I had to go and find an older version of this on Rumble where it still had it in the film.
Interesting.
Why has he cut that bit from his film? He's cut that bit from his film because he knows that's not on. But he is in the book still. And in the older version of the film, he says, I left the camera there for 2 hours. I returned at 10 o'clock. And sure enough, the cars have gone off the drive. So I've got to review that footage and see who comes out of the house. It'll be interesting to see if the daughter is in that footage. And so what it is he's basically driving around living in his van. And he's set up a camera on the dashboard, which is aimed at this person's house. He's been around to the house before. Knocked on. He says, it's weird. The windows were open and all the cars were there, but nobody wanted to answer the door and speak to me. So he went, set up a camera, went away for 2 hours and came back. Now, in the book, he says that he saw a woman who he identified as being the mother, a young girl in a wheelchair, and somebody that appeared to be a carer. And he finds this incredibly frustrating because it hasn't provided him with any answers.
To But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm holding on.
They then go back to sort of statement analysis and basically say that in the Genevieve Lewis has examined 33 statements, which is over 25% of the participants. And they look at the case of Safi Roussos. Safi Roussos was 8. She went to the concert with her mum and her older sister, and her father and her brother were outside. Her mother ended up in a coma, and Safi sadly died in hospital. Now, Richard thinks that this is a clue that Safi actually died prior to this, because he says, why did they pretend that she died in hospital? Why wasn't she at the 7 o'clock incident? And he says that's because she died beforehand. And it shows an interview with her dad saying that she was a massive Ariana Grande fan. Like, that's why we took her to the concert. But Richard thinks that this is suspicious. Richard says, well, they're obviously trying to convince us. This is them trying to set up a narrative. And Genevieve thinks that basically she's 8. When she was 8, she wasn't interested in Ariana Grande. She was interested in dolls and prams and things like that.
The fuck?
She thinks it's very unusual that an 8-year-old might want to go to a concert. Anyway, Ashley Roussos, who is the older sister, says, I was thrown to the ground and my next instinct, I sort of just rolled over and I crawled because I couldn't walk. And Genevieve Lewis says, that's a bit weird. What was her first instinct? That doesn't make any sense. It's a need to explain. And Richard points out, she doesn't mention trying to get up. So how does she know that she couldn't walk?
This is insanity.
It is starting to get a bit like that.
Also, one thing I want to say is it annoys the fuck out of me because one of my fondest memories was seeing Bon Jovi. I was 10, but it wasn't far off 8, right? And I was looking forward to that for a year. So, I mean, piss off, man.
Yeah.
I was so into music from a little tiny, tiny kid. I loved it. Everything about it.
Totally. Like, that's dumb. I don't like that part.
There's loads of bits here. She basically said, Ashley was saying, no, I couldn't see anyone. I just saw crowds and crowds of people. I didn't see my mum. And Genevieve Lewis says, why aren't you looking for your loved ones? This is strange. And Richard and Genevieve think this is evidence that actually the older sister was never at the concert. She certainly wasn't in the foyer. Her dad basically says, I turned around the corner. I saw Ashley outside injured. And Genevieve Lewis says, why would you say injured first? He's trying to convince us that Ashley was outside, hence lying about it to reinforce the official story. Now, this is where it gets very, very speculative. Andrew, who's the father, says that he was told in hospital, and this is while his wife is in a coma, that his daughter has died. She's 8 years old. And he said that he was told by a detective. And Richard and Genevieve think this is very, very suspicious because this is, why didn't the surgeon who was operating on her tell you? Why was it a detective that told you? And this is where Richard comes up with an interesting idea. He suspects that Safi Roussos died before the event. He specifically says on film that he thinks that Safi Roussos died at home due to the negligence of her parents. And that's where the detective comes in, because he's remembering the detective telling him that the child is dead, telling them that they will both be charged with manslaughter and that the police have used them killing their own child through negligence as leverage to blackmail them into pretending that she died at the concert. And Genevieve Lewis, for some reason, agrees with this and says that this is a plausible scenario.
Just at the suggestion of it, not actually like any sort of evidence?
Yeah, she says it's plausible. She says it's absolutely plausible that would be an explanation for why she doesn't think a detective would give the bad news. It's an explanation for why he's got that detective prominent in his mind. And because she's going along with, she thinks it's happened in the morning because of Richard's convinced her with the EXIF data, she's now thinking, well, hang on, I know this sounds crazy, but following my training, this is indication of deception. What might that mean? Now, Lisa Roussos, she's the mother. She injured her hand. So there is some discrepancy because basically, like, she said in an interview that she was in a coma for 6 weeks. And it was reported in the newspapers that she was in a coma for about 2.5 weeks. And so for whatever reason, she and her husband have both on camera said the 6 weeks. And they think that that is quite strange. But anyway, Genevieve Lewis thinks that they're all lying and Richard agrees. So of all the statements analysed, the 33 statements analysed, 23 indicated deception, 10 were inconclusive but unreliable. And so Genevieve and Richard say that nobody is reliable. None of the witnesses' statements ever from anybody at Manchester is reliable. They're all lying to cover up the fact. And the only explanation of this is to cover up the fact that basically there was an event in the morning and nobody really died. So what actually happened? This is Richard's explanation of what happened. And it is quite lengthy, but I feel that we need to give the whole thing because this essentially sums up his theory.
We need to hear it out.
Yeah.
So what actually happened? Here is my opinion based on the evidence I have found. The 2017 Manchester Arena bombing was a well-organised and well-planned fake terrorist incident involving over 100 enlisted participants or actors. The participants had been coached and briefed on what their roles would be in the event. The pre-planning of the event must have involved thousands of man-hours of work by security services personnel. Care would have been taken to select suitable participants to ensure they would adhere to the narrative given to them. The recruitment process probably involved bodies such as schools, colleges, hospitals, charities, businesses, clubs, and other networks. The vast majority of participant groups were chosen from broken and low-income families. Some of the participants had criminal records. These factors made it easier to persuade or reward the participants so they would adhere to their pre-agreed narratives. Looking at each group of participants, the need to know was limited within every group to a maximum of 2 families. Only trusted members of immediate family were informed and recruited into the exercise. Friends and extended family of the participants were not informed about the exercise and were made to believe the official narrative. Participants were probably coached to ensure they looked reasonably convincing in media interviews. Many participants would have been supplied with fake injury kits comprising fake wounds, blood, etc., and instructed on how to use them. Of the participants, about 20 were to be given new lives in other parts of the world, and it would be reported in the media that they had died. New homes for those being relocated would have been organised in advance. Perhaps one or two of those named as deceased had already recently died prior to the event in an accident or some other scenario. Around 60 participants played roles of being injured to varying degrees of severity. Just over half the injured ran out of the foyer immediately after the bang, the rest remained on the floor. Around 30 family members played the roles of waiting in the foyer to collect their children. The exercise involved at least 2 scheduled mock terror operations. One took place in the Manchester Arena foyer at 7 a.m. on 22/5/2017. This involved about 20 of the deceased and some, a fairly small number, of the other actors, arena medical staff, SMC staff, and some British Transport Police. Participants taking part in the 7 a.m. drill were instructed not to tell anyone about where they were going that morning. In the first exercise, the 20 or so dead lay down on the ground with fake blood, etc., as is normally the case in terror training drills. Photographs and video were taken showing the dead, along with some of the survivors, with SMC, arena medical staff, and British Transport Police attending to them. The purpose of the first drill was to obtain images showing the deceased people on the floor so they could be used in media reports the following day. Some of the bodies could be approximately matched to those who were declared dead, such as Marcin Kliss. After the first exercise, most of the 20 deceased left the arena and at some point were relocated. Australia and the USA were the 2 most popular places where they relocated to. Another exercise started at 22:31, immediately after the concert. This was intended to fool the public that a major terror attack had taken place in the foyer. Of the 90 actors, around 60 played the role of concertgoers, and the remaining 30 played the role of parents collecting their children from the arena. At around 22:20, SMC staff cleared the foyer, during which time the 30 parent participants started to arrive to wait for the other members of their group. The 60 actors who were inside the arena watching the concert had been instructed to head to the foyer during the last song, or at 10:20 p.m. Once the 90 actors were inside the foyer, SMC staff closed off access to the foyer so that nobody would see what was going to occur. Once everyone was in position, an actor playing the role of the terrorist, MI6 asset Salman Abedi, entered the foyer and placed a large rucksack against the wall and then ran out of the foyer. The rucksack contained a pyrotechnic device which, when detonated, sounded like and looked like a large explosive going off, but caused no physical harm. It was very loud and gave off a bright flash and produced smoke. When the device detonated, the actors immediately played their roles, screaming and pretending to be injured. If a bystander had been present, it would have looked to the untrained eye like a real attack. Some of the actors had been instructed to run from the foyer out of the Victoria train station entrance, others out of the main Hunt's Bank entrance. It was necessary for concertgoers to see some of the injured exhibiting fake injuries. Some were instructed to lie on the floor in the foyer pretending to be hurt. SMC staff ensured that the concertgoers on the concourse side of the foyer doors were panicked by shouting "run," indicating something bad had happened in the foyer. The organisers of the drill spent a lot of time and effort to make the injuries seem real. They used a number of people who had already sustained injuries or complications before the event in everyday scenarios such as accidents. I believe these included Hannah Moan, Martin Hibbert, Amelia Tomlinson, Lily Harrison and Adam Lawler.
He then goes to explain why this would happen.
Why would the authorities go to such lengths to plan and carry out a fake terrorist attack and in doing so attempt to deceive the entire general public? I could probably write another book attempting to answer this question. I suspect the event was influenced and organised to some extent by the security services of the United States for geopolitical strategic purposes. The majority of the legwork must have been carried out by UK security services. My guess is that there was some agreement between the UK and US security services to stage this event. That's not to say the United States government dreamt up the idea. Israeli political influence over the United States should be considered whenever there is a Middle East aspect to Western military operations.
Drink!
Chug, chug, chug!
That's exactly what we said earlier, yeah.
These kind of events provide justification for our government to take action both internally and externally. They allow our government to pass stricter laws which further infringe on public freedoms. They allow our government to justify bigger budgets for the security and intelligence services. They also make it easier for our government to take military action or other types of action against the state or ideology that was perceived to have carried out the attack. In Manchester's case, Libya or Islamic extremism. You might also be curious about how it is possible for so many people to be involved in such a massive deception. Why don't people in the security services or the participants speak out? Within the security services and other agencies that are involved in staging such attacks, I suspect there is a belief that these events are necessary to protect national security. Some of their personnel probably believe that the Manchester Arena hoaxed attack was a useful disaster preparedness exercise. The exercise was a test of how effective our response would be. It was a test of how well the media could put across the desired narrative. It was an exercise in which to learn things and thus improve preparations for the next real terrorist attack. The hoaxed attack, although deceptive, was working for the greater good.
So that is the crux of Richard's theory, basically, in the film. So The Night of the Bang, the book, there are certain additions that aren't in the film, obviously, because, you know, he's got more space in the book. He reiterates right at the start that we know that the government uses false flag events like this using crisis actors because of the Boston Marathon in 2030. And he basically he states that was fake using crisis actors, and that shows that this is. And he then goes on to say that the arena foyer, the city suite, as it's sometimes called, is an enclosed area which is not easily visible to people outside. So the foyer would provide an ideal space for a controlled terror training exercise taking place at 7:11 in the morning. He also points out that the firemen were frustrated by being prevented from going into the arena to help people, and so were paramedics. And this is absolutely 100% true. And he suggests that if you were doing some sort of closed-off event, you would need to control the area by stopping people from going in. But then he starts to get into, he breaks down every single person that supposedly died and provides an explanation for what he thinks has actually happened to them. So the first two were Philip Tron, who was 32, and Courtney Boyle, who was 19. Now, according to the mainstream, both died waiting for Nicole Boyle, who was the daughter of Courtney. She was 14, and she'd been to the concert. Nicole and Courtney's mom, who's Philip's partner, Deborah, was also there, and as was June Tron, who's Philip's mom. Now, Richard's investigation says that there are discrepancies in the press as to who went. Some say Courtney was at the gig. Some say she drove to pick up Nicole. A family member says they went to Manchester early to shop. Deborah also said that they picked up Nicole from Leeds University. But Richard says that they must have been there at 7:11 a.m., but they were not there in the evening. Now, he got an email from a fan saying that Nicole and Deborah, the relatives, they were at a graduation in June 17, which is only a few months after May 2017. And he says that he's very suspicious that they're smiling in this photo because it's only a couple of months after they've lost people very close to them. So they should be very, very miserable. He says that there's a picture on their Facebook of San Francisco that's labeled February. And so Richard thinks that Philip Tron and Courtney Boyle have actually escaped to San Francisco. He says that Philip has no ties and that Courtney was at university doing criminal psychology. And so Philip, because he's got no ties, can just disappear wherever he wants. And she's gone to university in America to study criminal psychology. Now, Richard thinks that the discrepancies in stories about who went, who got picked up, et cetera, was because they had to lie about being there at 7 a.m. Genevieve Lewis says that she thinks that June Tron, who is a relative, is lying. She said when she was being there, she felt like she was being lifted up in the car. The bang lifted the car. And Genevieve Lewis says that, why say a bang, not a bomb or a blast? And she thinks that's because she knows that it was fake. And she also suspects that this is very strange that Nicole, who was only 14, was there at a concert on her own. And so she essentially thinks that they're lying. Marcin and Angela Kliss, they were a Polish couple, and they were there to collect their two daughters, Alex, who's 20, and Patricia, who's 12. Unfortunately, due to the confusion, it was over 24 hours before Alex actually got the confirmation that her parents were dead and had sadly both died in the foyer. But according to Richard's investigation, that didn't happen. Now, he does acknowledge that there is a picture of Marcin and Angelica that's taken in Manchester, supposedly just a few hours before the concert, so indicating that they were there in the afternoon. But he doesn't really think that this is real. He says this could have been taken at any time. Now, also, he acknowledges that in the John Barr footage, you can clearly see a large, bald man wearing a red shirt, which is exactly the same shirt that Marcin was wearing in the photo taken, lying down dead next to a blonde woman that looks very much like Angela Kliss. But he basically says they were just filmed there for the 7 o'clock event in the morning. This doesn't prove that they were dead. Now, Richard points out that their daughters live together in quite a nice house in York, and apparently he knows that the mortgage has been paid off. And he speculates that that's the reward for it. Now, he did actually hear from a source that 12-year-old Patricia visited Poland at some point after the bombing. And so he suspects that they're not dead, that the parents have gone away to Poland, and that the children have been left with the house as a reward. And Genevieve Lewis thinks that Alex, who's 20, is a liar, because in an interview where she was talking about her experience of the night of the bombing, she says, "We were then evacuated to a hotel. One of my mum's friends had picked me up from Manchester and she took us home." Genevieve Lewis says that she shouldn't have said us, she should have took me home. So the use of the word us is indicative, according to statement analysis, that this lady is lying about the death of her parents. Liam Curry was 19 and Chloe Rutherford was 17. They were a young couple that went to the concert together and they sadly died in the foyer. But according to Richard's investigation, neither of them were there that night. They'd already jetted off abroad. Liam's dad supposedly died in March 2017, which would give him enough time to go away and set up a new life as well for Liam and Chloe to follow. Now, Liam enjoyed cricket, apparently, and there was supposedly a picture on Facebook of the Rutherford, which is Chloe's family, and the Currys, which is Liam's family, on holiday in Australia in autumn 2017. So the families are obviously very close. Australia is very famous for cricket. Liam liked cricket. Is that an indication that the family have gone over to Australia to visit Liam and Chloe? Now, Richard says that basically the reason that both of this young couple were able to go is because they have no ties. They are a young couple, basically, who are free to go ahead. There's an error there. If you spot it, we're going to come back to that. But if you spotted that. Elaine McIver and Paul Price. Paul Price didn't actually die, but Elaine McIver sadly did. Now, Paul Price bought tickets for his 13-year-old daughter and her friend, and he and Elaine went for a meal and then turned up to actually collect them. And sadly, he was injured and badly burned and put into a coma, and his partner, Elaine, died. Now, Paul had actually met Elaine after a bad divorce, and they'd been together for 10 years, and they apparently were very, very keen on one another. And it has been painted in the mainstream as being a complete tragedy. But Richard thinks that this emphasis on their relationship, rather than being evidence that they had a strong relationship, is evidence that it's contrived, completely made up. And he says that the picture of them that is shown in the mainstream of them as a couple is photoshopped. And he just thinks that Paul is playing the part of a distraught partner and that his relationship is fake, which would mean that essentially, because the relationship is fake, Elaine has no ties, and so she's gone abroad somewhere. Now, UK critical thinker found that between the ages of 5 and 8, Elaine lived with her parents in Melbourne, Australia. So Richard thinks that she wasn't there in the nighttime at all. She was already on a plane to Melbourne. Again, she apparently, according to Richard, has no ties. And he also thinks that Paul's injuries have healed too well and doubts that he was in a coma. He speculates that the leg injuries that he sustained were actually from a motorbike accident.
He's a doctor, of course.
Evidently, yeah. Alison Howe and Lisa Lees, they were there to pick up their daughters, Darcy Howe, who's 15, and India Lees, who was also 15, and they were very sadly killed whilst waiting in the foyer. The husband of one of them called a friend who was working at the arena to get details and heard the worst, that there'd been a bomb incident, because he knew that his wife was going there. He knew someone that worked there. He phoned up. Richard thinks this is very strange that they knew somebody that worked there. And also, Lisa Lees's daughter, Lauren, also had worked at the arena in a show set capacity in the past. So he speculates that perhaps that's the connection, because obviously he says that Shosek were in on it. That's why none of them died. And so this is the connection. He says that Alison Howe had once been on holiday to Florida, and she'd visited a place called Dolphin Cove, and she'd put on her Facebook that she thought it was great. So he thinks that both Alison Howe and Lisa Lees have escaped to Florida because they have no ties.
Yeah. Interesting. Sounds nice. Hope you don't like Disney, because it's very politically charged over there at this point.
Well, this is it, isn't it? Michelle Kiss and Ruth Morrell. Now, Ruth Morrell is the woman that's got the bolt through her leg, but Michelle Kiss was her friend, that died, who Genevieve Lewis says they're not friends. So they went together to pick up their daughters, Emily Morell, who's 12, and Millie Kiss, who's also 12. And sadly, Michelle died, and Ruth and Emily were both injured. Now, Richard doesn't believe her because she was apparently walking with a bolt in her leg, and he doesn't think that there's any way that this is possible. And Genevieve Lewis also suggests that the language shows that these two women were not friends, and even suggested they weren't there. Now, Richard also says that Millie, 12, is an accomplished actress, and so it would be very easy for her to play a part. But none of them were there in that evening, but he doesn't know where Michelle's been relocated to because there just simply isn't enough evidence to make a guess. But he knows that they're all lying, and Genevieve Lewis has confirmed this through the statement analysis that we talked about earlier.
So a lot of this is deduction. Like, you know, when you have a statement and you sort of go, okay, you said this, he said that, okay, I'm going to go with this. But using deduction as some kind of basis for fact is very dangerous. I mean, it could be right. I'm not going to say it can't be right. And I'm going to say that I'm giving it an A+ for effort.
He's tended to put all of his eggs into one basket.
Mm-hmm.
And it very much depends on what you think about the basket, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, as we've pointed out, there are people who swear by this or apparently swear by this.
False flag people.
Well, it's not. Well, the police agencies, the FBI and stuff like that, on the surface, it looks like there is a degree of confirmation that this is actually a useful tool. We'll come back to that. Don't panic.
Yes. But it's interesting. It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Wendy Fall, who's age 50, said that she went there with a friend, Caroline Davies, to pick up her daughter, Charlotte, who was 15, and Caroline's sons, Ben and Lee. Unfortunately, Wendy died, and after the death, it was suggested that Charlotte might go and live with Caroline, but this didn't happen. Richard's investigation showed that Wendy would normally see a friend each morning at 9:15, but on the day of the bomb, she didn't, which indicates that basically she was probably at the 7 o'clock event. Filming is in the morning. He doesn't know where she is, but he says that she's got no ties, and so she's probably left the country, and she definitely wasn't there in the evening. She was recently divorced, but her husband got married sometime after the bomb, and he looks after Caroline, the daughter. But Richard says that the honeymoon would be an excellent opportunity for the daughter to go away and meet her supposedly dead mother. Now, Genevieve Lewis obviously says that Caroline, who's the friend, is lying in interviews due to pronouns. Caroline said, Wendy said to me, we weren't, you know, there were quite a lot of people about. We weren't expecting so many people. And she said, I'll go that way and you go that way and then we won't miss him. And Genevieve Lewis says that it should be that we won't miss them because they were there to pick up both of their sons rather than them. And this is indicative of lying. Safi Roussos, who was 8, went to the concert with her mum, Lisa, and her sister, Ashley, who's 26. Her dad, Andrew, and her brother, Xander, were there to collect them. Safi was 5 meters away from the bomb when it went off, and Lisa was in a coma for 2.5 weeks. Now, Richard's investigation says that he thinks that Safi died at home due to negligence by the parents. And he thinks that it's very, very strange that they left their chip shop home after Lisa recovered from her coma. And he says that the reason they've done that is because bad memories, because this is where they, due to their parental negligence, caused the death of their 8-year-old child. I want to make that absolutely clear. That's what Richard is accusing these people of. Richard thinks that reports that Safi was a huge Ariana Grande fan are contrived, and she doesn't believe that she was a fan at all. Richard thinks that she's too young for the concert, and he doesn't think that there's any evidence that she's at the concert, except, now, to be fair, he does acknowledge that there is a picture of her with her sister at the concert.
Okay, that's a big concession.
Right.
It is, but he also points out it might be fake. He also points out that basically you can see Lisa Roussos's finger in this picture, and she loses that finger later in the bomb.
That's awful. Yep.
So Richard says that's obvious that this is Photoshop.
Okay, weird. Because how could she have lost the finger? Yeah, because it's all done by this production company or whatever. Oh, my God.
Exactly.
I'm getting a bit upset.
Well, this is it. And basically, they think that The family are deceptive in interviews, and there was a member of the public called Paul Reed, and he basically found Safi as she was lying dying and comforted her for 31 minutes before she sadly passed away, or before she was taken to the hospital. And Genevieve Lewis suspects that this is a lie too, that Paul Reed was never there and that he never cradled this poor dying toddler in his arms.
Was there a basis for that, or like...
She just thinks finds his language to be deceptive.
Just deducting it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just doesn't like it. Yeah, cool. Cool. What?
Sorrel Lukowski, who was 14, she went with her mum Samantha and her gran Pauline Healy to collect her sister Sophie. The mum and gran were both injured, and Sorrel, who was only 14, sadly died. Her grandfather said that she was a lovely, talented girl who wanted to study architecture in New York. Now, here's an interesting aside. Pauline Healy had her purse stolen by Chris Parker. Chris Parker's the homeless man that took the initial photos, and it transpired that he ended up stealing credit cards from some of the dead and a purse from an injured lady, and was later found out with this and was sent to prison. But Sorrel was actually at school that day, so she couldn't be part of the morning exercise. And Richard speculates, well, she died in hospital, didn't she? Just like that other person. So maybe the people that died in hospital couldn't be at the 7 o'clock event.
Okay, right. Okay.
He's sort of fucking everything.
Absolutely. But anyway, the family still live in a council house. So he's curious because he says they don't seem to have received any money.
Oh, surprise, surprise.
But here's one. The family do seem to know a family called the Mellors. And the Mellors live in North Carolina, America. And apparently in March, so just before the bomb, a couple of months before, the Lukowskis actually went to North Carolina and visited their friends there. So Richard thinks that Sorrel went to North Carolina to study architecture, this 14-year-old girl. Now, Richard has put in his book that he has got several contacts in North Carolina who are staking out and watching the Mellor house to give him any information.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, again, he's trying to find out whether there is indication that this girl is living there, this child. So he's got fans, people are out there who are basically have said that they will watch the house to see if there's any suspicious activity. Yeah. Jane Tweddle, she went with friend Joe Aaron to collect Joe's daughter, Izzy Aaron, and her friend Kim McCowan, and she sadly died. After the bomb, Kim's parents drove to Manchester from Blackpool to pick her up. Joe, Izzy, Kim were then told that Jane was dead at 23:05 and left 15 minutes later. Now, Richard phoned up the dad and chatted to him. Wanted to know about the description of the driving to Manchester. And because of repeated use of the word I, he thinks that he did actually drive to Manchester, but that no one else was with him. He just drove there so that he would be more accurate in retelling the story later. And he finds it suspicious that Phil McCowan was once in the military. So this is an indication that he might be in on it, basically. But he says that Jane was never there and she's moved to Australia where her daughter lives. So that's his take on that.
Before we go into any more of them, I need to address something.
Mm-hmm.
And admit something, all right? Like, being the conspiracist that I was, when you just said about the people in North Carolina, you know, stalking out these people, like being extra eyes, there's an author that we know called William Ramsey. You know William.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's done a book now on the Smiley Face Killers.
Yes.
Which is like about a bunch of allegedly like maybe a cult that operates in various cities that push people into rivers.
Yep.
Now, I live in Bristol, and between, I think, 2015 and 16, maybe somewhere like that, I'm not sure on the dates, I'll go back and check, there was 3 river deaths of men in Bristol that matched this criteria.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was very into that.
Yeah.
Like, I was, like, checking it out. So I messaged him, and I was like, dude, I live in Bristol. Like, to be fair, like, I actually kind of work not far from where one of them has just died.
Hey.
Do you want me to go down there and take some video and pictures and everything? And he was like, yeah, if you can. So I went there and I did recon for him. Mm. And I did, like, I took pictures of where, like, CCTV would have caught the guy. I walked from the nightclub. Like, I did the for him.
Mm. Yeah, wow.
I showed this is now where he would have, like, fallen in the river. This is what happens when you go on. Oh, look, here is a graffiti of a smiley face. And I went to three different locations, both me and my partner. We did this. We, like, did recon for this guy. So it's like we're doing the same thing that these other people in North Carolina are doing for Richard. And I just thought, you know, we get involved in this because we're...
You mean well.
Being a you're being a conspiracist. You're kind of, exactly, you're trying to be this, like, a internet sleuth, essentially.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's participatory, which is this whole ridiculous thing. Where looking back on things like JFK, you can speculate, but now you've got this idea that you can suddenly be a part of the journey. You know, you're a member of the club, and that's what worries me. Because while I love you dearly, people who do this tend to be idiots, and they tend to be unpredictable and terrifying. And in places like the US, where you have very easy access to guns, that's a recipe for fucking disaster.
It can go wrong very, very quickly, can't it?
Very, very quickly.
And that concludes part three. Thank you for listening to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. Tune in next week for part four. And as always, if you subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/somedarecallitconspiracy, you can listen to the full 8-part series right now. Thanks again.